Hello, welcome to episode 5 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm your host, Rob Mitchell. In this episode, I present an uncut fireside chat between Bitcoin Foundation board member and longtime digital currency entrepreneur Brock Pierce and GEM CEO and founder Micah Winkelspecht. Their conversation is followed by an audience Q&A, and I apologize for the poor sound quality of the questions. This was recorded at a Los Angeles Bitcoin meetup on November 13th at the beautiful new GEM headquarters in Venice Beach, California. This is a longer episode, but it never gets boring. I think you'll enjoy. Take it away, Micah.
We have Brock Pierce here. So he's probably one of the, if not the most prolific Bitcoin investor in the space. I think he did, what, like 35-something deals this year for different companies. So he's pretty much invested across the spectrum of companies in the Bitcoin space. And so I want to bring Brock up to the stage here. It's also his birthday, so everybody say happy birthday.
You have to pick favorites?
Well, in this case, it's obvious.
Yeah. Obviously,
Jim. He's an investor of our company, too, so.
Thank you for the birthday wishes. Technically, yeah, that's at midnight tonight, though.
We're going to open this up to Q&A really, really soon. I just want to get it started, and I really want people in the audience to ask questions because that's really where the best content comes from. You guys are probably tired of hearing me speaking. So, Brock, can you tell us maybe just a little bit of your background in terms of how you found cryptocurrency? I know you have a long history there.
Well, it started out in the late 90s, and I got moved into the business in the early 2000s, or specifically 2000. I had started a company during the dot-com bubble, raised a bunch of money, ultimately imploded, and at the end of that process, it's called, okay, I'm a college dropout, washed up actor, lost nearly $100 million of other people's money, and the only skill I arguably have is as an internet entrepreneur, at a time that no one wanted to talk internet. And the next idea I had is that people playing online games or that were participating in these persistent worlds had a desire to buy and sell these digital assets, virtual currency, virtual goods, and no game company really was doing that at the time, and so I created a secondary market facilitating players of these games to be able to buy or sell these assets. And that ended up being an interesting idea because people playing games like World of Warcraft actually wanted to buy things or wanted to sell things. The problem I had, though, is that I had more buyers than sellers, and so I needed to find a way to source more inventory. So I taught the Chinese how to actually play video games professionally for the purposes of mining virtual currency to then sell into Western markets. And I built up a supply chain over 2002, 3, and 4 of about 400,000 people that were playing games to make money. So, you know, these ideas were not novel to me. And over the course of the 2000s, there were many conversations with people saying, well, what about building sort of an open loop currency, something that's, you know, outside of, you know, this closed loop system where that value only had value within that, in, you know, call it closed world, similar to like a frequent flyer mile or, you know, any of these sorts of affinity programs. And, you know, the challenge is, how do you actually get enough critical mass for that, you know, that asset to have value? And I was engaged in conversations for years and years and years. And so naturally, Bitcoin showed up on my radar right from the beginning because people are saying, what do you think of this? I'm like, okay, I better take a look at it. I better have an opinion. And my initial reaction was, wow, this is pretty cool and novel. But, you know, I've seen lots of people discuss things like this. I've seen lots of attempts at it. And I, you know, admittedly didn't truly recognize, you know, how novel Bitcoin was at the time. But my position was, this or something like it is the future. You know, the question is the future now or 25 years from now? And so I took a sort of wait and see approach for a little while until Bitcoin actually pulled off what I thought was going to be incredibly challenging, which is creating a critical mass of users that have all agreed that this has value, and so that a market actually, you know, exists and has momentum. And the minute I saw that the future was now, I basically dropped everything I was doing to jump into this space full time, subject to one last major concern, which was regulatory. It's called, okay, who's not going to like this, and what are the risks in doing so? And I probably spent a good 3 to 6 months operating in the space, mostly doing things like mining, a ninja, kind of trying to keep my face out of the public as it related to the industry. And I decided to jump, you know, in and get very active in a more public fashion as soon as I realized it didn't really matter what this government or any developed, you know, sort of country did, because this still had incredible applications specifically in the emerging markets. And when I realized that I wouldn't be wasting my time, even if it were outlawed in a country like this, I said, okay, there's no reason not to move.
So you were in the currency space for a very long time. The question I have for you is, what is intrinsic value, or what is it that gives currency value? Why does something have value? Because, you know, obviously video game currency was, up until when you created that market, was just a closed loop system, and really was only useful for buying, you know, goods and services in that, inside of that game. How did it break through that, and why does it have real value?
Well, I guess, you know, intrinsic value in most of these things is ultimately because of consensus. We all agree, or because we have faith or trust in some system that's, you know, been imposed on us. As it relates to the video game space, it was ultimately two sort of motivations. One is it provided utility, you know, it enhanced your gameplay experience in some for some particular reason, or there was sort of social status and vanity. You know, you can buy a Lamborghini or you can buy a Prius. You know, some people choose to have something, you know, different, though it's not necessarily providing much greater utility, but it changes your sort of social status in a particular market. And those are the two motivations for people playing these games. But yeah, intrinsic value, what is gold really worth? You know, I don't think that gold has all that much value. It has all the attributes that you've identified, which made it a very good, you know, form of money. But most of the value in gold is just because it's been being used for thousands of years because it had those attributes. It's not because it's really worth all that much. You know, I mean, why do U.S. dollars have value? I guess it's primarily because we have to pay our taxes with it.
So there's utility in paying our taxes.
Well, it's called we don't have a choice.
Yeah. fiat. So, yeah, does Bitcoin have that? I mean, you know,
value in Bitcoin itself? I guess it's ultimately the Bitcoin blockchain and the cost of replicating it. You know, the all that mining sort of infrastructure and the cost to replicate it could be argued to have some sort of intrinsic value. You could look at, you know, how do we, you know, value anything? How do you kind of look back? What is the enterprise value of an asset? And I mean, there's arguments I could make that there is intrinsic value, and I could make arguments that there is none. The question is it a good form of money? And it's, you know, it has all the attributes of gold, but better in pretty much every single way. It only lacks one attribute that gold has, which is its intangibility.
Yeah. So I get a question a lot then is, you know, especially when you talk to banks, because, you know, banks, they're very sort of old world mentality, and it's hard for them to imagine that, you know, some upstart currency would ever take over their job, you know. So what they always tell me is they say, you know, we're really fascinated and interested in blockchain technology, but we don't believe in the currency. Where do you stand on that between the two?
Well, I think that's going to be the general response of most people that live in the developed world, because for most of us, we're fortunate enough to be born in a place and in a household where our families had access to bank accounts, and you know, we live in a country where there's, you know, mature sort of payments infrastructure and credit cards that make things convenient. Most people have faith in the commercial system. We've got rule of law, you know, that's supposed to be there to protect us. And of the 200 currencies in the world, if you're from the developed world, you actually have one of the currencies that most of us would actually like more of. And so when you come from that sort of state of mind, and that's, you know, what you know, it's easy to form that opinion because, you know, the marginal utility and the way that it impacts your life is, you know, it's going to be, it's not massive. It's not the sort of thing that's going to change your life by an order of magnitude. I mean, the U.S. dollar is, you know, decreasing in value, you know, the purchasing power of it by about 2% a year. And, you know, for most people, that's not, you know, you don't really feel it in the same way that you boil a frog. Now, if you're a member of the 70 million people in the United States that are part of the on or underbanked, or if we go south of the border and take a look at Mexico, you take a look at all of South America for that matter, specifically Argentina and Venezuela. You go take a look at Africa. You take a look at Southeast Asia, where all the things that I just described that we have, for the most part, they don't have. The vast majority of the populations aren't banked. you know, currencies, you know, are incredibly unstable. And, you know, in your lifetime, you're most likely going to see your country or one of your neighboring countries, you know, entire financial system collapse and all of your family's wealth and savings, you know, being, you know, basically vanishing on you overnight. You have a bunch of these sorts of issues that make something like Bitcoin as a currency, I think, you know, it's a far better thing that will enhance your life by an order of magnitude. And if you take a look at something like Africa, where, you know, this infrastructure doesn't exist, in the same way that they leapfrogged wired telecommunication and went straight to wireless because they had, you know, none of that sort of incumbent infrastructure there, you know, they can leapfrog into something far more advanced. And if you think about like a place like the Philippines and these spots, I would argue in the Philippines less than 5% of the population is banked by our standards. You know, they have the ability in a very, very short period of time for the entire population to be banked. It should take 10, 20, 30 years for the developing world to, you know, catch up with what we'd call our financial infrastructure. And now in the matter of months or years, they can not just catch up with our infrastructure, they have the ability to surpass our infrastructure and actually have a better financial infrastructure because of the blockchain, Bitcoin, or potentially even a central bank in some of these places putting their currency on it. But again, in a lot of these places, their currencies don't, you know, they don't have the same benefit that the US dollar has. You know, the US dollar is not going to go away anytime soon.
Do you think it ever will? Do you think this will be a currency that actually replaces all currencies or something like it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, everything fails eventually. Everything. It just, you know, this is too big to fail, at least in the near term. I mean, everything fails eventually. So the question is it going to be in the next 10 years, 100 years, you know, 500 years? But I'd say at some point, you know, that's likely to happen if you look at history.
So do you think we'll have banks in 50 years?
I mean, yeah, I'm not of the opinion that all intermediaries go away because of the blockchain and what this technology enables. It eliminates intermediaries and counterparties that are not adding value. You know, there's, if you look at the value chain, it's comprised of many, many sort of intermediaries that are performing some particular function that likely had a use at some point in the past. You know, but a lot of those things aren't needed, and a lot of them are not even providing any value today. I mean, a great example of that, of anyone that, you know, bought any real estate or sold any that, you know, I find just to be utterly worthless is, you know, things like title insurance, where you're paying 1% of the value of your transaction for what? So some company can go say that there's a clear chain of title. By using the blockchain, you could do one transaction where that insurance company has now said the chain of title is clear. Put that onto the blockchain where you have a complete, you know, you have a public ledger that is showing that chain of title. Right. And
in other words,
eliminated
you're paying,
that. And we all save 1% anytime we do a real estate transaction. That's what I'd call a counterparty that is adding no value.
Right.
You know, now to use another real estate example, the real estate agent, you know, or the real estate platform, you know, that's connecting buyers and sellers is providing some value, whether it be marketing. They're enhancing the value of your property. They're connecting you with someone that might buy it. They're facilitating a sale. And that would be an example of a counterparty that's providing value and a counterparty that's, you know, not really adding any. So the value chain will likely be collapsed. A bunch of intermediaries will be disintermediated. And in the end, we, the consumers, will benefit. So do I think that we'll, you know, have things that look like banks? I mean, it depends on what your definition of a bank is and what specific role. The idea of just storing our money, yeah, they're probably going to look like Bitcoin wallets. You know, and I could argue maybe that is what a bank is in the future. But do I think that there's going to be some tool, service, or, you know, entity, or, well, I'll avoid getting into the decentralized, you know, sort of entities or DAX and DAOs, but is there somebody there that's able to add value by creating a product or service that helps us facilitate, you know, payments and transfers of, you know, things? I believe ultimately that's true, at least for some period of time until everyone can program and there's no need. But again, even still, there's an opportunity for someone to create interfaces that make those sort of actions easier in a way where we agree that there's value that's been provided.
Yeah, I think that's roughly true. You know, this crowd here all has Bitcoins, so maybe we'll actually approach distributed organizations, something we don't usually do. But I would love to talk to you more about, I mean, I know you're actively involved in a lot of blockchain 2.0 type projects. First of all, can you define blockchain 2.0 or Bitcoin 2.0? and then tell us what's interesting that's going on in that space.
Yeah, well, I guess my definition is, you know, there's probably a number of different definitions, but I think of it as anything where you've moved beyond Bitcoin, the currency, and where you're figuring out how to use either the sort of blockchain protocol for some other use case, whether that be, you know, title insurance, like we just talked about, and showing that, you know, using that ledger as a way of facilitating the transfer of some other asset or settling of it. Things like smart contracts, anything that you're building on top of that second layer, whether you're using a platform like Counterparty or, you know, the MasterCore protocol or colored coins or, you know, soon to be side chains. I think of anything kind of beyond the currency and things that just facilitate, you know, basic you know, transfers and payments and things of that nature with the currency is what I call kind of Bitcoin 2.0.
And what do you think is really exciting in that space that's going on right now? You're really on, you know, the pulse of it.
Well, I still think we're kind of where Bitcoin was in, you know, call it 2008 or 9. You know, most of it's still a white paper. You know, it's mostly conceptual. You know, some of it now is, you know, seeing the beginning of the light of day. So, I mean, I'm fascinated by sort of the utility of this technology beyond just the currency, but it's still kind of early days. The things that I find, I mean, smart contracts, and I'm just dying to meet people that come up with interesting applications of how can you build smart contracts into anything utilizing the blockchain. The reality is I haven't seen that many, call it, good applications or people that have identified a specific market use case and actually developed it and pulled it off in any way. But I'm very eager to meet those and find ways to participate in helping those people grow their projects. I think Reeves here in the room, that's pretty cool. Not everyone likes this idea, but I think it's an interesting one, which is putting fiat currency, or in this case, the US dollar, on the blockchain. I think it's an incredible gateway to engaging people with the technology as a way where it's often hard to sell. You know, anyone that's in this room right now is taking the time to think, which is, you know, unfortunately not true of everyone. It takes time for, you know, early adopters are the ones that have taken the time to say, hey, this is interesting. I'm going to go spend an hour to learn more about it. But most people in life don't contribute an hour to go learn about something interesting until, you know, kind of the really early adopters are followed by that next wave of adopters and so on and so forth. And so Bitcoin can be intimidating to a lot of people. It certainly had its run through, you know, sort of reputational issues due to sort of media sensationalism of mostly things that are not really large issues, but, you know, that's what the media does. You know, they're there to make stories that people want to read by having a controversial headline, clickbait. Yeah. But I think it's a great way to give people what at least many people around the world already want. You know, you go out and offer anyone dollars and pretty much everyone's going to say, yes, I'll take them. Maybe you want to convert them to Bitcoin immediately following that, but, you know, pretty much anyone will take a dollar. And putting the dollar into the ecosystem and using the same applications and making it all interoperable, I think is a great way to get people engaged in a product like this, and where Bitcoin's in their face all the time, and eventually they're going to get it as you go through these adoption curves. But I think that's a pretty interesting application. I'm a believer that the stock market's what you've seen Overstock.com do, if you haven't seen it yet, the idea of crypto securities. I mean, if you take a look at the stock market and how it works here in the United States, and if you go watch Patrick Byrne's speech at the last Inside Bitcoin, if it was recorded, I'm not sure, but he does a very good job of describing kind of how the stock market works. Most people think that when, you know, I buy a stock or you sell a stock, it's, you know, we've just transacted and stock and money changes hands. That's not really how it works, but then most people recognize, yeah, there's probably a stock broker that's there and, you know, our brokers are facilitating, but that's not how it works. There's a contractual right built on top of a contractual right, likely yet again another contractual right, and behind that is the DACC, which is again just a contractual right and similar to the Federal Reserve. It's not regulated and there's very little visibility into what's in it, and even the DACC doesn't own any of the equity. Behind them, there's yet again another entity that actually owns 100% of all the stocks that are being traded in the public markets. None of us have ever owned any. And you start looking at these systems. In this case, that's one that's working well enough. It'll take a long time, but you know, 10 or 20 years from now, I imagine the NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange, pretty much the entire equity markets are going to be, you know, we're going to be having digital sort of crypto securities. So I find that to be fascinating, but I think it'll take a long time. But you know, Overstock.com and these kinds of guys going out there and, you know, pointing out the issues and providing a, you know, an interesting solution for it, I think is great. I mean, the list goes on. Voting, I think, is a phenomenal sort of use case. You know, voter sort of corruption, you know, even exists in this country. And in some countries, it's an incredibly big problem. The idea of giving out a token that represents one vote to every person, you know, in a particular country where democracy exists with a public ledger, it's an uncorruptible, trustless voting system. You know, I mean, the applications for, you know, this technology are anywhere where value is being transferred.
Yeah, so I guess the idea behind Tether is really to get people into the ecosystem and then they don't have to leave, right? Because they can essentially just transact in dollars inside of cryptocurrency world. They don't have to do any fiat exchange after they're already in that realm.
Yeah, I mean, again, the dollar use case might not be the best of them.
Yeah.
It's just the easiest example because this is the room we're talking in. But if you take a place like the Filipino government recently announced they want to put the peso on the blockchain to create the e-peso. Because, again, it's back to the banking issue. When a government can cause their entire population to become banked and provide them with financial services, it's probably the greatest thing that they can do to improve their quality of life. And, again, it allows them to leapfrog, you know, sort of the developed world in a very short period of time with better financial infrastructure. And so I, you know, commend the Filipino government for actually being smart enough to understand sort of the application of the technology and how that can enhance their country and GDP growth and everything that comes with it.
I think we're going to start to see several nation states do that kind of thing.
Specifically in the developing world, yeah. And ones where you don't have major incumbents with major political sort of abilities to slow that down.
Yeah, so one of the things that's in the Bitcoin news, not the general news, but in the Bitcoin news a lot lately is sidechains. And I know you've been, you know, pretty much talking about it a lot in social networks and stuff. So can you kind of describe very briefly what sidechains is and why it matters?
Yeah, so I'm an investor in that company. If you think of the sort of the Bitcoin blockchain being the most, well, why do altcoins exist? The protocol as it's been developed with its confirmation times and 21 million, there's a bunch of sort of hard-coded rules into the Bitcoin blockchain. And some people have said, well, I don't think that's the right way to do it. Maybe there's a better way to do it. And so lots of altcoins were, you know, created for the purposes of trying to, you know, further refine the model as in an attempt to do something better, unless you're talking about something that was truly sort of a scam or a pump and dump. But most people were actually trying to do something novel and finding some way to further innovate. Then you've got, you know, sort of the Bitcoin blockchain, which is by far the largest of all of them, the most secure of all of them. And instead of, you know, everyone building a new alternative blockchain, which it's going to be very, very difficult to get the type of scale that you need to provide security, people said, well, let's figure out how to build things on top of that blockchain. If you think of the Bitcoin blockchain as being sort of, or the blockchain being the TCP/IP layer, how do we build an application layer? And that's what Colored Coins sort of pioneered. And now you have a number of other platforms that have basically built that application layer so you can build things on top of that highly secure network. Sidechains being something similar to that, where you're saying, let me create like a set of chains that tie back into that central blockchain using a two-way peg system so that I can innovate around what is that very large, very scaled set of infrastructure that's here instead of having to create an alternative blockchain that's not going to be highly secure. I think that's probably a pretty simple way of putting it.
So do you think it's going to be used mostly for improving the core protocol, or do you think this opens up a lot of new possibilities that we haven't thought of and terms of, you know, like one of the examples I like is our friend Tatiana, who has she's an artist and musical artist, and so she launched her own coin, Tatiana Coin, and it's a excuse me. At first, you can laugh at it, you know, that some individual is just going to make their own coin with their own name, but I think it actually opens up a really interesting question, which is, you know, what are these currencies anyway? What I think is really interesting is that, you know, it actually opens up a new way to sort of fund a career, right? You know, if I say that I make widgets and the only way you can buy my widgets is if you use widget coin, I can essentially create a closed loop economy. And so she's kind of doing this with her own art and her own craft and saying, hey, you know, you can use Tatiana Coin to buy access to my concerts or to buy special merchandise. And it's a way to basically do a really unique form of crowdfunding by using a closed loop cryptocurrency that essentially empowers her to do what she wants as an individual without having to get a job or without having to do something else. I mean, if it works. and it sort of funds her career. And you're starting to see, I think, you know, that's one example, but you're starting to see how these cryptocurrencies, these altcoins, are being used to fund all different types of companies. You're starting to see a whole new way of how companies come to existence rather than going through the traditional investment route. They're now doing these sort of crowdfunding and crowdsourcings. You know, there's platforms like Swarm that are now coming out to enable companies to be able to launch their own cryptocurrencies.
An investor in that.
Not surprising. And so, you know, in the crowdfunding space, what do you think is the future of crowdfunding? Where do you see that going?
I mean, on the, you know, the many currency front, we have thousands of, you know, sort of closed loop currencies today in the world that, you know, function. So I still envision there being thousands, if not more now, as that gets easier to develop. So I think there's still going to be many that are, look more like affinity programs. They're loyalty systems to improve retention with your customers or your fans, in the case of the music industry. Yeah, the crowdfunding world is another one that I find, you know, very fascinating right now. I mean, the ability to go out and say, I want to pre-sell a product and service or service in a Kickstarter type fashion, but using, you know, rails like this to fulfill that and have a token that represents the value that you're eventually going to have and the ability to transfer and trade it without actually having to maybe move the physical products or service, if there are any, you know, I think it's great. I mean, again, this lowers the barriers to entry. It increases efficiency. It allows the settlement of things to happen you know, faster, all in a public sort of transparent ledger fashion. So I think that, you know, this will be very innovative. And, you know, from a, in the same way that Bitcoin democratizes the financial system and it allows everybody access, you know, I think that the crowdfunding, you know, sort of world has done that as well. I mean, entrepreneurs, whether they want to pre-sell a product or service or they're looking to raise capital and, you know, in exchange for offering, you know, upside in their business, you know, that whole world had been historically, you know, again, held by a small handful of people. If you wanted to make a consumer package good, you needed to go get buy-in, you know, you needed to raise capital, and that was something that was hard to finance historically. Or you needed to go get a purchase order from a, you know, a Best Buy or, you know, a Walmart or, you know, one of these companies. Now you have the ability to go direct to consumers and say, here's my idea with an idea or a prototype, and let the consumers vote. And what that's done is it's created a you know, a flurry of innovation. You know, so I think what that's done from a, call it a crowd sale perspective, to be different, you know, very distinctly different from a crowdfunding perspective. But I think on the crowdfunding side, that's happened as well. You know, historically, if you wanted to invest in early stage technology companies, if you weren't part of a tight-knit group of sort of insiders in the know, you were never going to get access to the best deals, which means you were only going to be investing in second or likely third rate deals where it's not likely you could ever make money. And so what that's done is it's kept a lot of capital out of the markets that would have been here to finance us as entrepreneurs. And now through this sort of democratization of the early stage finance world because of platforms like AngelList and cryptocurrency, I think you're going to see a lot more capital coming into the market to finance entrepreneurs, which again, I think is a great thing because it's going to create and drive further innovation. So I love it in, you know, every which way.
I would even take it a little bit further and say that, you know, one of the other cool things about it is that it essentially turns your own customers and your early adopters, the people who love your product the most, into your investors. So they have a vested interest in spreading the word and spreading the message to their friends and growing the product organically. And so you're really well aligned with, you know, your investors are aligned in the company, even more so than, say, a traditional investor would be. I think that's really exciting for what it can do for the future of companies. And that takes me to the next step, which is...
Well, that's good and bad as long as you deliver on time.
Yeah, true. So we've seen a lot of that. False promises. So that takes us...
They go from your biggest advocates to pitchforks are out.
Yeah, mob rule. So, you know, there's always a balance there. But it takes it even further. So, you know, like when I think really, really far out in terms of what cryptocurrency can and probably will do on a long enough time horizon, it really calls into question, what is the very definition of a company? And does that definition change? You know, there's always been a very traditional model. You go to the people who have money, you ask for it, they lend it to you or they invest in you. You go and you build your product and your surf, you sell it to a bunch of other people who actually want your product, and you pay all the money back to the investors, and the investors keep that money. Does this change the definition of what it means to have a corporation or a company where you don't need the investors anymore because your customers are your investors, you're building a product directly for them, the exchange is direct, person to person, and then take that even a step further, and do we even need anybody in the middle, or can we have distributed autonomous corporations and things like that?
Well, I mean, I the answer is yes. Clearly, eventually, I mean, what is a corporation? You know, I mean, it's a company that's been registered, you know, with the state or government, and you got papers that get filed, and you know, paper stock certificates, and we're moving into e-shares. But even then, they're just, you know, kind of holding the stock on behalf of all the shareholders. Do you really need any of that stuff, especially as we move into a world with, again, smart contracts where you can have, you know, instead of lawyers documenting things, you can program a set of rules, you know, that, you know, allows you to kind of eliminate a lot of that activity, and you eventually get to the point where, okay, you can have all of those rules assigned to, you know, the token holders that are essentially acting as the shareholders in this entity that doesn't actually exist as a registered entity anywhere, but all of us that own it, you know, not likely because of, well, I guess you could even see yourself in some ways having a consensus mechanism where if 51% of the people agreed, you could probably even sell a decentralized autonomous organization to someone depending upon its rule sets and how it was architected. Or more importantly, you probably end up with a dividend sort of paying structure where, you know, those that own it are seeing their currency, you know, expand. You could, I mean, there's all sorts of cool things.
And of course, that can also be programmed in as well.
And you could even have it where, you know, it's an interest bearing instrument where that, you know, you've got one share, and the longer you hold on to it, it turns into two shares and three shares. And, you know, in the same way, Bitcoin mining is increasing to 21 million coins. I mean, that's the cool thing about sort of the smart contract component to this. If you can imagine it and design a set of rules, you can build it. And so I think the answer is yes, we're going to end up there, you know, eventually. I think the main thing that's going to slow that down is those of us aware of it, those of us understanding it, and ultimately those willing to buy into it. You know, we need, you know, sort of mass adoption to occur for that to reach a point where it can happen at scale. You know, because as of right now, you know, we're probably only about 5 million people in the world that have taken the time to become truly engaged in kind of this activity and the things that are happening here. And that number needs to be a lot bigger. Or if you're someone that's trying to do something innovative, you're still better off, you know, in the old world because you've got, you know, better access to capital markets. But, you know, I think Bitcoin, the currency, and the currency applications are the ones that are going to be driving the mass adoption, which then allow, you know, kind of wave two and wave three of the innovation to, you know, happen. But I guess it's possible some other opportunity using the technology could end up becoming the mainstream thing that actually drives the adoption, which then brings it back this way. But currency seems like the, you know, the most important one. In the same way that the Internet of Information has eliminated borders in our ability to move information instantaneously anywhere in the world, we should be able to move money or value in the same way that I can send a text message or email today. And so I think the Internet of Values applications around money and commerce and payments and things of that nature will be the main thing that drives adoption. Again, specifically because in the emerging markets, the existing payment systems require trust. And, you know, a majority of the world's population doesn't have the ability to buy anything online today because they come from a place where our payment architecture and systems say, we don't trust you. And this eliminates the need for trust, and it allows every human being on the planet to participate in the internet economy. So I think that's the thing that will drive sort of the mass adoption that allow these next waves to, you know, sort of come to fruition.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I always liken Bitcoin payments to email. In the early days of the internet, you know, it was that first killer app. It was one of those fundamental changes that really changed everything, and you got it for the first time. But to say that the entire internet is email is pretty ridiculous. You know, in today's age, we look at it now, and it's just like one tiny component, and we've even moved on to other types of messaging and stuff. But it was that sort of linchpin that unlocked incredible value in the internet. And I think we're still in that early stage of development where payments is everything everybody's talking about. And we're building the other layers right now. We're building the JavaScript. We're building the HTTP layers. We're building all the other layers that allow for all these other services to come up. And payments will always be integral to that in the same way that email is still integral to the way we use our web services and stuff. I mean, you know, we still rely on our email box every day, even to this day. I think payments are going to be exactly like that, that it is that sort of linchpin that unlocks everything else. But it is by no means the only thing that we're going to see. And it's really just the early, early days. That's what gets me so excited about the space. Every day it's changing. And
it's like 1994, 1995 internet days, but we're all a lot smarter and see how things can scale you know, in the most extraordinary ways now.
And hopefully investors are more sane, although I don't know. We've already out-invested.
They were insane back then.
Yeah. But we've already out-invested Bitcoin companies. There's been more venture capital investment in Bitcoin companies than there was in the entire internet, right, in 1995?
Yeah, we're at 1995 levels, but that number's misleading for two reasons. On the negative, I don't think that's inflation adjusted, but that I don't think that's the negative. The thing that's really changed here is what it cost to build a website in 1995 was, I mean, it was extraordinary. I mean, it was $1 million to make, you know, a website that had any interesting sort of feature set. Now, because of, you know, Amazon Web Services and, you know, software as a service and open source and, you know, you've got, you know, all of these things that have changed, money goes a lot further now. So, I mean, we're far, I think, beyond where the internet sort of funding was in 1995 because money just goes much, much, much further. You can build a business with $50,000 today. You couldn't imagine doing that in, you know, even 2005.
And to that point, I think it's going to move a lot faster this time because the internet required a massive amount of hardware infrastructure to be built before it was actually massively useful around the world.
And more than that, too, you had to change human behavior.
Yeah, right.
You know, human behavior was, I mean, there were still people going, why would I want to use email? I mean, I can, you know, letters work just fine.
Yeah. You know, I can buy a stamp.
But, you know, the whole, it took a long time for the internet to develop because you had to change human behavior from living in an analog world to moving into a digital one. You know, we're all digitally connected now, and that's the reason why things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat can see these extraordinary user adoption rates because we're all connected at this point. So the speed at which things can, you know, grow, you can't compare this to 1995. It's going to happen in a much shorter period of time if we're all lucky.
I agree. Of course, I'm biased, but
I think we all, at least a bunch of us, are.
Today's magic word is money, M-O-N-E-Y. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB coin distribution on letstalkbitcoin.com. I've been putting off having paid advertising on the podcast, but I decided I'd try plugging my own product, the Bitcoin Keychain from bkeychain.com. If you'd like to have your own Bitcoin keychain, just like the ones that literally hundreds of websites pictured represent Bitcoin, go to bkeychain.com and find the merchant you want to buy from. You'll get the best prices when you buy from one of the little guys who accept crypto only. You also find a bunch of cool Bitcoin and other crypto products at these shops. Besides, you should use Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies when you can. It's good to be hands-on, and it's good to support the shops who actually do commerce in Bitcoin for Bitcoin products. But alas, the keychain is also available for fiat on Amazon.com. Just costs a little bit more there. Bitcoin keychains are fun to have. They're great conversation starters, and they make great gifts to and from Bitcoiners. Check them out at bkeychain.com.
I want to open it up to questions because honestly, that's where the best content comes from. So if you have a question, we don't really have traveling mics, so go ahead and just speak really, really loudly.
In the scenario you described where the Philippines, where you have unbanked participants, say you have a local craftsman and a potential customer, in that scenario, what kind of hardware is required for a transaction and who owns it?
Well, I mean, I think what you need is a phone. And I think in the Philippines, the phones far outnumber the people. So I don't think this is much of an issue. I mean, unless you're in a really remote part of the world, pretty much everyone has phones at this point, and that's what's enabling all of this. I mean, even in Africa, I think the smartphone penetration rates are up to 30%. I mean, phones are going to be everywhere, and I'm not concerned about that. And I think that's about all the technology you need.
Yeah, and also, having a phone is having
a bank in your pocket.
In Kenya, you know, one of the most popular forms of currency is actually not even the local currency. It's mobile airtime minutes. They're so used to using alternative currencies and their mobile phone in order to transact that for them, it's a no-brainer. For us, it's different because we've got a huge history of using the wired internet and existing banking infrastructure. In Kenya, it's not that big of a leap to change to a different alternative currency that you use on a mobile phone. It's really quite easy.
Yeah, where I see mass adoption occurring is either Argentina and the Philippines because of sort of government sort of financial instability. Kenya, because it's the most advanced mobile payments market in the world. I think the number is 68% of people in Kenya are using their phone to pay for things. And they're using, as you said, you know, SMS minutes. This was pioneered maybe 10 years ago in a few places like the Philippines as well. I always called it the telco standard instead of gold.
A central authority anyway.
Yeah, but I just invested in a company in Kenya, which I'm very excited about for this reason, BitPesa, because I think BitPesa can just, I think they've got the ability for sort of mass adoption in a, you know, a hyper sort of local area in a short period of time. Or I think it, again, will be in a place like the Philippines where I think it's 28%. It's some very high number of the Philippines' GDP is money remittance. And so you could see mass adoption. It's in English, meaning they can follow a lot of the things that we talk about and do. And they're one of the most social societies when it comes to social networking in the world. You know, maybe, you know, sort of Malaysia, Indonesia as well. But I see those as sort of ground zero for mass adoption markets. Sorry.
As you know, I kind of pitched around ideas to build the system that you were talking about, but I haven't been able to find the right system to build it on. I've tried notary chains and even blockchains and whatnot. Do you think your 2.0 sidechain solution is ready, number one? Number two, will you invest in it?
Well, I mean, I commented on this as an interesting one, and one for, you know, anyone that's bought or sold houses, where, you know, you just kind of go, you feel robbed, you know, when that payment is made. But you know, I can't speak for sidechain specifically because, you know, sidechains don't yet exist. It's, you know, it's in development, so it's too early to really say, but I think so. You know, you've got, you know, a number of other meta layers that are available to do things like this, and it's a matter of productizing it, you know, in a way that you get people to adopt it. You have to productize it in a way where, you know, the buyers of real estate, and you have to figure out how to structure it in a fashion where people agree that they're going to use this, because you have to present why it's useful, you have to present why it's effective, you have to pick a market where, you know, you can figure out how to get that existing title insurance, because you still have to make sure the title is clean. And so you have to figure out how to move that title sort of tracking onto a blockchain where that last transaction is basically proven, okay, it's a clean, clear, and title. Now it's on a blockchain, and, you know, productize it in some fashion. And I'd love to, you know, continue to have that conversation if, you know, someone presented to me the right product, which is normally, you know, where I like to invest. It's not just idea. I want someone to show me, okay, here's how I think it's actually going to work. And here's a minimally viable product, you know, that we've kind of developed, you know, and present to fashion. And here's, you know, from a business model perspective, how money can still be made because we're providing value and we're just doing it far better and, you know, much more efficiently. When entrepreneurs are disrupting things, they're normally not ending an industry. They're normally figuring out how to just do it much cheaper, faster, safer, and such. And I think that that's one where, you know, it's highly bloated and we're overpaying. And I'd love to see someone present a product that's been thought through and ready to be implemented and brought to market.
One last comment. The only problem I've had there is that proof of concept. So between developers in the room, you want to capitalize.
Yeah, I mean, I can envision, you know, how that technology is going to work. The issue is, how do you productize it and how do you get it to be accepted to the extent that it can be enforceable around, you know, under sort of rule of law. And that's, those are things I don't have the time to think through. And that's where, you know, the entrepreneurs that, you know, want to build in that space hopefully do.
There's that hard part of dealing with the real world, right? Like, there's an entry point to get into cryptocurrency. Yes, it's this beautiful system, but somehow you have to cross the chasm between what happens in the real world and cryptocurrency. And I think Tether is sort of an example of what, you know, you're trying to do that. You're trying to create that bridge so that you can deal with dollars still while you're in the cryptocurrency world. But things like Tidal, you have to have that sort of origin, genesis transaction that says, hey, now this house is on the blockchain. And that's the hard part, I think, is making a system around that. And then also, you know, the sort of the changing of the guards, the old world, like trying to get the old world to adopt this new strategy. So it's like a long horizon, but it's one of those things where I look at it and it's like, yeah, it's obvious, it's inevitable. It will happen, no doubt. There's no, it's the most efficient way.
And that's the A to B versus the A to Z analogy. It's very easy to describe, hey, you know, I'm going to start this business and this is how it's going to look, you know, at scale, the Z. You know, but the real challenge in building that business is actually getting from point A to point B. It's getting that first sort of implementation right, because once you get that right, it's very hard to go from zero to a million of revenue. It's much easier to go from 1 million to 10. It's that, you know, that first sort of piece in getting that right is the real challenge.
Regarding regulatory compliance, I can understand a company like, say, Coinbase, which is working within the banking system trying to get right with all the regulations. But I mean, if you look at the example of, say, a company like Uber, which is saying we're not a taxi service, therefore we're not subject to your taxi regulations. I think that there's some room for a Bitcoin company, like say an ATM, for example, to say that we're not a bank, we're a vending machine, basically. So if you buy something from a vending machine, you don't need to swipe your ID card or, you know, scan your fingerprint. And to me, the idea that you have to show ID to buy Bitcoin just kind of seems to blow apart the entire idea of Bitcoin in the first place. And I would think that, I mean, you don't even have to show an ID to vote, but you have to show an ID. So where are these, I mean, I hate to say it, like, they need to do this. I mean, why aren't more people trying to say, look, we're not a bank, we're not subject to these regulations, and try to go around the regulations?
Well, it's ultimately fear of going to jail, I think.
The penalties are pretty harsh.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing. I mean, when we talk about what is a security, when we talk about, you know, sort of equity instruments and, you know, all of the laws surrounding that, and, you know, the SEC, the government could probably get away with calling a ham sandwich a security. I mean, that's the issue we ultimately run into here is, you know, how much risk are you willing to take to, you know, make a point, especially when you've founded a company that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars and you're going, wow, the lifestyle ahead of me looks pretty sweet. Do I really want to risk it all? And that's, you know, the challenge we all face. And, you know, some people are going to go, you know, be pioneers and stand up for, you know, what they think is right. And, you know, they'll either break new ground in the way that Martin Luther King has, or, you know, they may end up, a lot of people are going to go challenge those things, but it's, you know, very easy to understand also why, you know, some people are saying, well, I'm going to comply. And, you know, Uber does comply. Uber is taking a position, they're fighting that battle, but they're not just going completely, they're not just defying all regulation, they're fighting regulation. And they're doing the best to do that, and it's a tough battle, and they're ultimately going to win for one reason. Because what they're providing is ultimately good for us, the consumers. The taxi unions are in the wrong, and they provided a shitty service for a very long time, and they've been protected by unions, and Uber's come along and provided something that's great for us as consumers, and they got big enough that we're not going to let it stand. And they will eventually win that battle. It may take a long time, because they're providing something at the end of the day that it's, and again, good for us as consumers. The politicians that represent us are supposed to be doing what's good for us, the people. That doesn't always happen in the way that we would like, but ultimately, you know, the thing that causes the things that we're doing to succeed is us being a very large critical mass of people. When you know, there's 100 million Americans standing strong that want the things that we're working on, that's when we, you know, the people are ultimately going to get what we want.
Be great if politicians had to actually ride in taxi cabs, then maybe the system would change faster.
As a visible investor and proponent in the Bitcoin community, do you find yourself personally getting any friction from potential incumbents and their associates?
in your travels and convention speakings and everything else you do?
Not really. I'm pretty practical, pragmatic. If you engage me one-on-one, I can sort of understand the position of both parties. I understand why banks are not jumping to bank Bitcoin businesses. I can understand that. I can put myself in their shoes and understand their position and then have a logical conversation from there. I'm not trying to argue with people. I'm trying to have a conversation with people to enlighten them and help them understand why this is important. And, everyone's got their methods. Mine are, try to engage in, an intellectual conversation to eventually win people over if your position is right and go through that debate process. So I don't ever find myself in that position, but I'm sure it'll happen eventually. But
no one's trying to knock off Brock Pierce.
Not that I'm aware of. let's hope not, but, I guess anything could happen.
I would say, I've had a lot of conversations with financial institutions as well, and I think there's a really strong misconception from the outside that the banks are trying to shut down Bitcoin or they're like stonewalling it.
They're not.
In fact, one thing that I've learned about bankers is that they're like the smartest people you've ever met, and they're really good at one thing, which is making money, right? So they know how to make money, and if they see an opportunity to make more money, they will go and take that opportunity. They're very opportunistic. So one of the biggest issues with the banks is not that they don't see the potential. In fact, they look at the blockchain technology and they're looking at all the applications of all the things that they do internally and thinking, man, we could eliminate so many people and save so much money for the company, and we can make so much more profit because blockchain technology solves all these problems of how we do a treasury and asset management and all these other things that they're looking internally. Not necessarily the currency part, but the underlying technology of blockchains. And the problem for them, the reason why from the outside it appears like they're totally stonewalling it is because the typical story is that a Bitcoin company can't get a bank account to do exchange. And the problem behind that is really a regulatory nightmare, right? So the bank is just really, they're doing like a sort of a cost-benefit analysis of like, okay, well, we could take on this Bitcoin company, but then we have to go through the compliance process, and it's super risky, and we're basically jeopardizing our entire nest egg for some little Bitcoin company that's making, very little money, and it just doesn't...
They're making very little money, and what does that mean to a bank? Right. Banks are looking at, hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars of fees and, potentially billion-dollar fines. It's right. Like, how do I justify this?
Right. So I think as the market progresses and it becomes more valuable, it'll become valuable to the banks as well, and those lines will soften. But certainly,
and they have softened.
Yeah, they have a lot.
Most of the banks are going, okay, this is interesting. I want to understand it more, and they're becoming open to it. But they're big, slow organizations. I mean, that's when you have a lot of when you've built something with tons of enterprise value. It inherently becomes slow by nature, and it's supposed to, so that a reckless CEO doesn't wipe out all that enterprise value overnight. Startups are meant to be, fast and nimble because they're trying to capture value. Large organizations are supposed to, protect that value, and by nature, they're going to be slow. And, but they're becoming interested, and as this becomes a larger industry, as the economic opportunity becomes larger for them, they're going to become more and more open to working with businesses. It's just they don't move at our pace.
But what you start to see is you see inside of the organization, you end up having little startup groups that are Bitcoin focused, especially the research guys who are like all about it, writing white papers internally, distributing it to people. They're really excited. There are pockets of people who are really excited about the technology inside, but they have to work within, a giant organization. So it takes time to really filter out to the top. And it's just an education issue more than anything. One of the things I like to do is I always offer myself up as a resource to anybody. And I say, look, if you want to bring me in, I will educate you on anything you want to know about Bitcoin. And that's the biggest way to spread it. Because once you understand it and you understand the basic technology behind it, it's hard to argue with it, right? It's just more efficient. It's just a better system. And so it's really about getting past those barriers and just saying, hey, look, and that's why I encourage everybody in this room. I mean, the best thing you can do is to educate people on what this thing is and take the time to have them understand it and bring them to events like this. And it's been just incredible to watch this group grow from, I think we had like 15, 30 people or something like that in the beginning. And now we have 950 people on the meetup group, and we're getting, We have to turn away people. I mean, it's crazy. So this thing is definitely spreading. It's growing, and it's because of individuals who are bringing their friends and educating. And it's a very grassroots thing. It's fun to be a part of.
Yeah, I do. I mean, market timing is one of the most important lessons I learned in my career. I started a business back in the 90s trying to deliver, you know, user-generated videos, think YouTube, you know, original programming made for the internet, think Makers, and licensed and repurposed video for the web, think Hulu, in 1997. So, I mean, the first lesson I was really taught and was ingrained in me was market timing. Timing is everything. A lot of entrepreneurs think their success is really tied to them. It's largely luck, and the primary component of that is, was your timing right? You know, subject to actually being able to execute. Yeah, that's a big part of it. It's the reason why the majority of my investments have been made in what I'd call sort of basic infrastructure. You know, we're still in that basic infrastructure phase where it's building bridges, roads, tunnels, you know, the stuff that allows the, you know, the technology to be usable by, you know, the masses, where you don't need to think about having a, you know, cold storage or a paper wallet. I mean, these things can't scale. You can't get mass adoption with those types of systems. It needs to be productized in a way that it's easy to use and you don't need to think about it. So a lot of what I've been doing is still in the basic infrastructure phase because that's where the timing is right. I'm interested in the 2.0 stuff, but yeah, it's challenging sometimes to invest in those projects because they often are very early. But you know, as the, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, you go in and those are the risks you take, and often it's better to be too late than too early is actually the sad truth of it all, because if you're too early, you're going to spend a couple of years working on a project and it's never going to go anywhere, and there's no one there to basically pick you up and, you know, roll you up into their larger project as you go through these industry consolidation phases. When you're too late, if you've done a good job of at least building a very competent team and good product, you can get sold to someone else. It's not a fantastic outcome, but you have those sort of market opportunities as long as you efficiently spent those resources creating value. When you're early, you normally end up drowning. if you're late, you often get past at least a life preserver, though your ship sunk.
So there's a little known fact that I was a child actor and I actually auditioned for one of his shows way back in the day when I was a kid. So secret. Don't tell anybody. Rob.
For both of you guys, what would you say in the past 6 months has surprised you the most, whether it's technology, adoption, regulation?
I mean, on the regulation front, I think I've been surprised by how well things have gone. I know maybe some people wouldn't agree with that, but I think on the regulatory front, things have been smooth sailing. I mean, to the as much as I could have hoped for, you know, because it's obviously one of the biggest concerns many of us have, and I think things have gone about as well as I could have hoped. There's fire and brimstone isn't being brought down upon us anywhere. we're left with an ability to innovate as much as one could hope around such a highly regulated industry, meaning money and financial services. What would be the other big sort of surprises? I've been surprised by the Bitcoin price being down, you know, kind of for as long as it has, and kind of a not a positive surprise. That's on the negative one, but and it concerns me as well. I personally don't care that much about the price because I have belief that, you know, what we're doing in the long run, in the long game of this, I'm a long investor in Bitcoin and everything going on in the space, so it doesn't bother me. But price is the sort of primary barometer of sentiment in terms of, you know, the people that are not in this room, the people that have heard of it and are curious about it. And, you know, it causes a lot of people that would be engaged not to be engaged. You know, a high Bitcoin price is actually going to drive mass adoption far faster than a low Bitcoin price. And that's because unfortunately, human beings are still driven by this sort of herd mentality. You know, most of us know the best way to invest is to, you know, buy low and sell high. But the reality is, much as we know this, almost no one does it. You know, we typically, you know, end up getting excited when things are at a really high price, and we buy in when we shouldn't, and you know, we sell when things are down because we're still driven by that sort of herd mentality. So the price is concerning, because for this to work, we do have to reach that critical sort of escape velocity. And there's a lot of things, incredible inventions, that didn't make it because they couldn't get that sort of velocity required to go big. I'm not worried about it, but it does weigh on me a little bit, because the price is definitely slowing it down adoption in some ways. And, you know, fortunately, the last, call it, 36 hours have been good. Been quite exciting. I think everybody's feeling a little wealthier. this weekend, if the price stays high, I think everybody's going to have a better weekend than maybe last. So that's been a big surprise of mine. The quality of sort of people from the outside world, you know, guys that have held senior positions in large organizations, you know, entrepreneurs that have had, you know, many successes. I've been pleasantly surprised by the sort of quality of talent that's now taking an interest in the sector and coming in. I think that's been a good thing. And, you know, we want our ranks to grow. It's essential. So that's I think, been pretty positive. What else would you add?
I mean, honestly, positive bank perception or acceptance has been very surprising to me of late. The quality of minds in the space, although that's actually not surprising because it is a pretty heady topic. But the rapid expansion, I mean, watching it grow so quickly, I think you're right in that it has slowed a little bit, but I think it's going to take another upswing. You know, especially as the price starts to climb again, it's going to bring a lot of people in the door. And this time we have such a strong base of people who now understand the technology. There's so much more that we have. You know, when the price was at the height that it was before, nothing was built. I mean, it was, you know, really just speculation. But now you have these systems and these more mature companies in the space, so that when that price does start to climb again and people start to come in, we're going to have the place for them to go. The infrastructure, and it's going to be a lot easier this time around. So it's going to be quite a ride.
Yeah, it was a huge difference. You know, when you saw this last run, you're excited, I want to buy some Bitcoin. You had to call your friend that knew how to program. it was a challenge for most people that took an interest in it. And that venture capital that's flown in doesn't immediately provide something. It's like planting a seed and then, you know, pouring water on it and giving it sunlight. It takes, you know, a year or two for that capital to actually turn into products and services that are mature. And, you know, this capital flowing in is definitely going to make a very big difference over the next couple of years in improving, call it that 1.0 basic infrastructure layer. And I think when this next thing runs, it's going to, you know, it'll be exciting to watch, and I think we'll all have a good time.
To the moon.
To the moon. Well, I mean, the basic infrastructure, more than anything, I think, is wallets. It's giving consumers the ability to safely, you know, securely be able to, you know, get their Bitcoins, along with the on-ramps and the off-ramps to get them in and out, and those might be one and the same. But it's called, if I want to go from, you know, the U.S. dollar economy to the Bitcoin economy, I have to have the ability to get my hands on Bitcoins easily. I mean, I got to be able to buy them fast, and all those channels, the on-ramps, and I have to then be able to store them, and it's got to be a really smooth sort of user experience where I don't even need to understand the security of it. It's just got to work, and it's got to work really well.
There's another change that's kind of happened in the last year or so where, you know, the early companies who got venture-backed and venture-funded, guys like Coinbase and stuff, they took a strategy of basically building everything. Building the entire ecosystem and trying to, well, you know, I mean, it was a very smart strategy, and Coinbase, I have a lot of respect for the company. But the strategy is becoming different now. The companies that are getting funded are more hyper-focused. So they're tackling one problem and going really deep on it rather than tackling every problem and doing it really broadly. What that does is it allows for specialization. It allows for better solutions all across the board. And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous for every company to try to reinvent the wheel on something. When somebody else has already built a great wheel, you might as well just build on top of it. Up till this point, that's not been the strategy. Every company who builds something has to start from ground zero, build the entire stack. And one of the problems with that, especially in this industry, is that this stack, the amount of deep domain experience you need to have to build this securely and to build it well is so massive. And really, the people who are good at building the infrastructure pieces are typically not going to be the same guys who are really good at building the sort of high-end consumer experience around it. And so we had a huge amount of companies in the space that had great tech, but weren't necessarily the easiest system to use. And so it gets relegated to a more technical user, a more power user. If you really want to cross that gap, you have to have an incredible consumer experience, and you have to have the trust that it's built on top of a very secure infrastructure. And so we're starting to have those solutions in place so that developers can now build on top of things.
And that's always true, though. When an industry is young and small, you're not gonna get a bunch of companies financed to specialize in each of these ways. And when these companies were getting started, there wasn't perceived to be enough value in here for companies to all be funded in a way to specialize.
I mean, yeah. AOL is a really good example of that in the early internet, right?
So yeah, it's always this way.
AOL was a company that did everything. You know, they were an ISP, they were a content company, they were chat rooms, they were everything, right? And that gets disintermediated over time, and individuals start to specialize, and you get better ISPs, you get lower costs, you get, you know, better consumer experiences, you get openness in the web, and then now we have what we have now, which is an open internet that's built on top of all types of infrastructure, and you have deep specialization even just in hardware with AWS and cloud services and all that kind of stuff, where they're just providing the lower level guts.
Amazon does a lot.
So Amazon does do a lot. They're kind of an exception, but...
They do it pretty well.
To be honest with you, all the cloud providers do a lot of things, but those systems allow for developers like me to be able to go in and say, "Hey, I want to build a website." Well, now I don't have to reinvent the wheel on server deployments and host my own email servers and all these things that you would have to do. And that's why the costs were so expensive in the early internet days for starting a company. You had to run your own server farms. You had to run everything. This gives the ability for developers to move very, very fast and on a better infrastructure and to provide better services.
If you guys could suggest tools that we use in Bitcoin could use for getting paid in Bitcoin or maybe auto-paying bills in Bitcoin or wallets, what would that be?
Well, I mean, the getting paid in it, call it the payroll services stuff is interesting. I didn't like the space at first just because I didn't think it was ready back to that market timing piece, because most of the only companies that are going to use a Bitcoin payroll service are Bitcoin companies, and quite frankly, there's not enough of us yet to make a market for that. But when you eliminate sort of Bitcoin on the surface, and again, you look at Bitcoin as the rails, there's a huge problem as companies begin to virtualize their workforce. And you've got employees in the Ukraine or employees in Southeast Asia or employees in Argentina, or if you're Google and you have all these AdSense publishers all over the world, how do you pay them? And the idea of saying we've figured out a way to get international payroll services and get money to people everywhere, you don't even put the name Bitcoin on it. You just say, hey, I found a way to pay everyone in the world really efficiently. There's a lot of big companies that have that problem in almost every startup out there. It's an area I find interesting.
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions that's still in my mind, is whether Bitcoin, the name Bitcoin, will ever be a name that the average person knows or thinks about on a daily basis.
Actually, if I could redo it, I would have given it a different name.
I would too.
I would have called it money.
But I always use the example that my mom, she doesn't know how the internet works. She doesn't know what TCP/IP is, or SSL, or now TLS, or any of these technologies that we use every day. She knows how to use.
Isn't money a good name for it if it were just called money?
No, you know why? Because I don't think that Bitcoin is money. I think Bitcoin is something even deeper than that, which is it's a system that allows for distribution of all types of services, and money is just one of them. So I think that it's even deeper than that. Money just happens to be the first killer app. and it's going to change the world just on its own.
Well, you'd still have the blockchain. I'm just talking about Bitcoin, the currency itself.
The currency itself.
You know, it's, the problem is money's really intuitive. Bitcoin was not, but anyway, we have what we have. Yeah. We ain't going to rebrand it.
So my question is, why don't we see mass adoption right now in the third world? Because as I understand, over here in the Western world, we don't mass adopt because the public opinion about the price is what's holding us back.
Yeah, it's awareness. Right. Awareness more than anything. People need to be aware of it. They have to understand why it's useful, and you got to have, again, a sufficient amount of people touching and playing it. I mean, awareness is the main issue, which is why. And also, there's not been investment capital going into these places. Investors typically want to invest into a Delaware C corporation. And the main reason for that is there may be an offshore market opportunity, but you can, back to a rule of law issue, I invest in a company in Africa in the same way that, you know, most companies don't want to sell products on the internet to people in Africa because of this trust issue. You run off with my money, what recourse do I have? And so most investors do not want to invest offshore. And if they do, it's going to be in, you know, mature countries, developed countries where there's sufficient rule of law and recourse if your money disappears. It's very, very difficult for investment capital to flow into these regions. And so a big part of the awareness issue is, you know, the boots on the street, if you will, you know, just haven't had money, and that's the reason why I'm so actively, you know, trying to invest in these, call it key markets, Latin America, Kenya, Philippines, because those are the markets where I think, you know, things are going to happen, and I'm trying to actually provide the operators on the ground there with the capital to do it.
Sorry, but why don't we see, because over there is a need, over here there is no need. It's not, we have other ways, but over there they have the phone, but they cannot buy the app through the phone. Why don't we see it coming from the public? Why don't we see
this? But the public needs to be aware of it. It's if you don't know about it, you know, you got to get there, and someone has to make people aware of it and get a handful of, because it's something that'll happen virally, and that's the reason I like Kenya, Argentina, you know, Venezuela. The Argentinian economy collapses, you know, and everybody's going, you got to get this Bitcoin. I mean, it's going to be at every bar, every restaurant, everybody on the street is talking about how do I flee into some other store of value. And it can happen very quickly. Again, in Venezuela, the same. Kenya, because 68% or so of the population, I might have my number wrong there, are using this for payments. M-Pesa is not that cheap. All of a sudden, everyone's like, let's use Bitcoin. They already, the behavior is already there. And that's why I think that in Kenya, you could see something like M-Pesa disappearing in a year or two. You could see just something like Bitcoin taking hold and becoming the primary payment system for a majority of the population overnight. And that's why I want to, you know, bomb that market with capital and guys in parachutes jumping out of planes and making everybody aware of it, because I think that's a market that is ripe for mass adoption in a very short period of time. But it's got to be sparked somewhere. It's that kind of capturing lightning in a bottle, and that happens because something goes viral. But for something to go viral, you got to have a bunch of people talking about it, and I don't know what will be that trigger. You know, but I'm comfortable, you know, putting some money to work to, you know, try and strike that nerve, you know, a dozen different ways, and hopefully we get lucky.
Do you see the big media companies jumping on the blockchain specifically in like the DRM area as a way of trying to control content?
Yeah, I think the blockchain is, you know, got, you know, interesting licensing applications like that. You know, your token is, you know, your ability to authenticate that you have a right to something, you know, and that token is that the thing that might be able to allow you to access something. And the I think, you know, again, similar to voting, or I've seen some interesting discussion around things like art and authenticating art and its reality, or luxury goods like Louis Vuitton bags. So you got a lot of sort of, or wine, counterfeit products. So when I buy a Louis Vuitton bag, not that I would, but let's use that as an example, not to slam the brand, just, you know, better uses of money today. I'd rather buy Bitcoin. I go buy that Louis Vuitton bag, and with that, I'm getting a digital token or a certificate of authenticity. Yeah, I could go then buy a counterfeit bag and sell that counterfeit bag and transfer the token along with it. But that counterfeit bag is now real, and my real bag is now fake. I mean, there are some potential issues there, but you can start to make that a way of authenticate, you know, a certificate of authenticity of sorts in a public ledger a system for representing I have, you know, rights to a particular piece of content. I think there's some interesting applications there, and similar to title insurance, I haven't seen that being done right, but I believe there is market opportunities there.
It's Brock's birthday, and he's got to get to a birthday dinner, and I don't want to keep him too long, but we'll take one more question, and then and after that, we're all going to go down to, I mean, you can hang out here for a little bit, but then we're going to go out to across the street to the other room. And so please come on down, network, hang out. We'll all be over there.
Oh, I want to add one other comment to the media side, which I don't think was the question you're asking, but I think the one thing that could drive mass adoption on the media side here in the U.S., which excites me, is microtransactions. Microtransactions are something that we've needed for a decade or two. And in the same way that you're seeing the cable industry finally being debundled, where we as consumers can get things a la carte, you know, I don't want to pay for 200 channels. I mean, I cut the cord 10 years ago anyway, so this doesn't really apply to me, but I don't want to pay for 200 channels. I want to watch 4 channels. Why do I have to buy 196 things I don't want? And we as consumers are finally getting what we want there. And that was a government issue. Again, government regulation, well-intentioned, but kind of always going wrong. And that was, well, yeah, there's a bunch of important public interests that need to be served, and no one's going to pay for that. Therefore, we got to, you know, let, you know, subsidize those things by forcing everyone to buy it. But in the same way that we consume content online today, I don't want to pay $20 for the Wall Street Journal. I don't want to pay $20 for the Financial Times. I don't want to sign up for any subscriptions, quite frankly. You know, I want to pay for things as I consume it. I'd much rather go down the freemium world, much in the way the video game industry went from a packaged software business and turned into, you know, a software as a service business, now into a freemium sort of microtransactions business. I think all content should, you know, kind of exist that same way. I'd rather try it, you know, on a freemium basis before I buy it. You know, if it's a Financial Times article, let me read half of it, and it's a nickel, a dime, a quarter to read the rest of it. And I'd much rather do that all day long as I'm consuming content. And the media companies, I think, are going to want this as well. Because, you know, if you look at how anyone that's on a CPM-based basis is, you know, a CPM is cost per mil or per thousand. You know, I think the average CPM on the internet is probably something like 20 cents or maybe even lower when you include the international markets, premium stuff, call it $3. That's still a fraction of a penny per consumption. If I can get, you know, in the same way video games have a 2% conversion rate, so I'm going to pay 5 cents. You know, when you start implementing a transactional model versus an advertising model, you can see a lot of sort of value in those businesses increase. I mean, the companies that are providing content, quality content that we're willing to pay for on a freemium basis, you could see the increase of these businesses and the value there by an order of tenfold. And the minute these companies recognize that they can increase their enterprise value by an order of magnitude, they're going to go push this model, you know, down into the market in a way where we as consumers could find ourselves, you know, using this in a short period of time. There's a few things that I see kind of potentially sparking mass adoption in the U.S., you know, but I think it's going to take some time. Otherwise, what is that thing that drives it? And I think if the sort of content companies that are providing content find a smart way to implement that, I could see it being beneficial to consumers as well as to content providers. Sorry, that was one other thing that I spent a lot of time thinking about from a media perspective.
Yeah, not to mention the privacy issues around the business model of advertising, right? So not paying for your service, if you're not paying for a product, you are the product, right?
So. Exactly. I'd rather pay a nickel and, you know, not have, you know, all of my, you know, sort of internet behavior being right. Bought and sold in the open market.
So one last question, so make it a good one.
Yeah, circling back on the topic of price, I've been involved in 2010. Every time I speak to people about Bitcoin, they're always saying, oh, the price dropped, oh, the price increased. And I want to get beyond the price. I want to talk about the application of the technology, especially my friends being doctors, lawyers, investors. What have you seen as the best method to kind of shift their focus or kind of changing the approach a little bit? Because I've tried so many different ways, and I haven't really figured it out yet.
Unfortunately, I haven't figured out how to do that yet in a soundbite either. Again, this is that problem of barometer being the primary driver of sentiment. Normally, I find I still need 5 or 10 minutes of conversation to engage you and present you with a use case. The main problem that most of them have, again, is why do I need it? And that's, you know, the big challenge. And then I normally get into an international market discussion and showing them how this is going to enhance and change the lives of billions of people around the world, which kind of in some way works almost to guilt you. You have the ability, you know, this is important. It's going to make lives better for, you know, people because we all want that. So I find that to be a pretty effective one, and it's one that they recognize. But unfortunately, you know, the price is that main driver of, you know, it's that main barometer for sentiment. And it's hard to get people past it because that's the surface thing. But the probably the shortest answer is actually talking about wallet growth year over year, Bitcoin ATM growth year over year. If you actually look at all the fundamental metrics, they're all up and to the right and at various sort of inclines. Every other metric is there. And that's the thing I'd point out. I'd say, you know, price is going to always kind of have these sort of up and down moments. But if you look at the fundamental sort of behavior and every other metric that matters, it's up and to the right. And I just name those and, you know, list off 5 to 10 of them. And I think that that's pretty effective, and you can probably get that conversation done in well under a minute.
I take a different approach to it. I talk more philosophically, and I say, you know, I really don't care about the price. What I care about is what can you do with this amazing technology that you couldn't do before? And it turns out you can do so many things. And so I always say, you know, what is Bitcoin at its core? Well, it's the most efficient way to move value of any kind from point A to point B anywhere in the world instantly with no third party in the middle. And I always say value and not money, because there's a lot of things in our life that have value that have nothing to do with money. And I use the example of voting. You know, a vote is an assignment of value. I'm assigning a vote. I have one vote to give. It's valuable to me. And I'm assigning a vote to a candidate or a measure or whatever it is that I'm voting on. So now we have a technology that didn't exist before that for the first time in humanity's history has the ability to allow for global, decentralized, distributed, cryptographically secure, verifiable, and auditable elections. This is a technology that has the raw power to revolutionize democracy around the world, and that's just one application of that technology, and there are tens of thousands of others, some that have been invented, some that are being invented, and some that we can't even predict.
Still takes over a minute. The problem is there is no good short answer. It requires actually engaging in a conversation, and it's very effective. And once you get someone hooked, if they spend an hour studying this, and if they're, it's the beauty of it. You just have to take the time one by one. You know, we go out and we educate 10 people about this and take that hour to truly help them understand why this matters. It's hard once you get bitten by the Bitcoin bug, you know, not to become obsessed with it. It's a religion.
And with that, thank you for coming to our church. Thank you guys. So we're gonna go ahead across the street.
Here's a little background about this meetup. Andreas Antonopoulos had been scheduled to speak the evening of the event, but his flight from the East Coast was canceled, and he tried super hard to make it, even piloting a Cessna to an airport nearby where he was stranded. He just wasn't able to make it. So Brock Pierce filled in at the last moment. And ever since I first heard Brock speak at a Bitcoin meetup over a year ago, I felt he was a really fascinating guy and probably one of the most knowledgeable people in many aspects of the Bitcoin space. And I don't think I've ever heard him on the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network, so hopefully listeners will find him interesting. There was also a great response to Micah from my first episode of the Bitcoin Game. I interviewed people at the Southern California Job Fair, and Micah was one of the people I talked to. Micah seems really technically adept. He's a big picture thinker, and he's a great speaker. He delivered a presentation about the history of money before Brock came on stage, and I'll try to include that presentation in a future episode. Please follow the BTC Game on Twitter or give me feedback on this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. You can go to thebitcoingame.com anytime you want to see a listing of all the episodes. And let me know how you feel about me plugging my keychains. It's been a fun venture and a way to be involved in Bitcoin commerce and community. And I guess that's kind of what this podcast is too. Thanks for listening.